May it please the court. I'm John Hensley, registration number 10525. Along with Paul Cooper and Jeremy Swift, we represent the appellants who will be referred to in this argument as the Ludlows. The appellees will be referred to in this argument as the brokers. As the court is aware, the issue in the trial court was a claim by the Ludlows against the brokers that they had negligently represented the Ludlows and made misrepresentations in that representation, as well as breached fiduciary duties with respect to the sale of land that was owned by the Ludlows, known as the Ludlow Farm. The crux of the issue in the trial court arose from one provision, which was a credit provision for the benefit of the buyer that was inserted by the brokers into the contract first presented to the Ludlows. This contract was a standard real estate commission approved form with an 8-page Word custom document addendum. In that addendum, there was one sentence which said that the buyer would receive a credit from the purchase price at closing. Nonetheless, in the standard form contract where it stated purchase price, there was no indication that there'd be any credit, no asterisk, nothing other than the approximately what ended up being about $6.5 million purchase price.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about the facts, if I might. $1,600,000 was withheld at the closing from the seller. Was that the sum agreed upon in the sharing of expenses agreement that's contemplated?
That was the amount that ended up being agreed upon in that, and it was the amount approximated what the buyer thought going into the contract would be the amount of the credit unless there were changes made during the negotiation of the cost-sharing agreement, Your Honor.
So did the sellers understand that it would either be withheld at closing or they would ultimately have to pay it in any event?
No, because it only related to the cost attributable to the land being purchased by the buyer. What the seller contemplated, and as the court would be aware in reading the full record on this, now bear in mind this is just summary judgment, so we don't have the benefit of transcripts of a full trial. But what the seller understood, the sellers had never been developers, hadn't parceled out land like this before. They had this farm, it was a relatively large tract. They did a conveyance plat to break it up into separate pieces which could be sold. It was commercial property. So what they were thinking was at some point in time it would be necessary for infrastructure to be brought in. Utilities, roads, wastewater, etc. And what was contemplated by the seller was that they would pay their share of the property that they retained if they still owned any of the property at the time that these infrastructure developments were made, and that the owners of the other parcels would pay their proportionate shares. Because of the one sentence the brokers put into the contract, here the buyer didn't have to pay the share for their property. That was cast back on the sellers.
So can I interrupt just for a second? You said twice now that the broker put the clause into the contract, and I guess technically that's correct, but doesn't the record indicate that the broker just didn't make that up? They put that in at the request of the buyers, Actis, correct? So it was Actis who asked that it go in the contract.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor, because the brokers prepared, you may have seen the record reference to the Bush contract. The Bush contract was a contract for essentially the same property that the sellers had. Bush went through their due diligence, and at a point in their due diligence, they decided not to go forward. Mr. Groves, who was the principal of Actis, knew Mr. Bush. He became aware this property was becoming available, and he wanted to go buy it. So he meets with the real estate brokers and says, I want to present a contract to the Ludlows to buy this property. So the broker took essentially the Bush contract with the addendum. There had been a custom addendum on the Bush contract. That addendum did not include this credit for the buyer. Mr. Groves said, I want a credit for the amount that we would otherwise have to pay because I want to buy land that's fully serviced. I don't want to have to pay to bring the infrastructure into the property that I am buying. So in accordance with that, the broker puts one sentence in which says that the buyer will receive a credit at closing for the amount of their share of the infrastructure. So it was at the request of Mr. Groves. It was put in there by the broker. And the reason we're here today is that the broker then, when giving the contract to Ludlow, says this is just like the Bush contract, except there's three differences. None of those three were this credit provision that the broker had just put into the contract. So we proceed with the due diligence. The contract's in February. We're coming to a closing. We get to the closing a week before the closing, or 9 days before the closing, when the settlement sheets are issued. For the first time, the sellers see this credit to the buyer for $1.6 million. Specific performance contract obligated the sellers to go ahead and close. The sellers went ahead and closed. They didn't get their $1.6 million. The record will show the brokers got their commission on the full amount, didn't even take a discount for the $1.6 million that the Ludlows didn't receive. The Ludlows filed this action.
Counsel, as I'm sure you're aware, there's a lot of cases in Colorado and elsewhere that stand for the basic proposition that you can't complain about a term in a contract you didn't read, essentially. Now, it seems to me that your clients are saying that because of what the broker said and what the attorneys may have done, that principle does not apply. Now, why is that? Why aren't they still obligated to read something before they agree to it? And then having agreed to it, how can they complain that about something they could have seen if they'd read?
Your Honor, the cases that you're citing, and that is a correct statement of law in Colorado, applies to actions between the buyer and the seller. And that's why they couldn't get out of this contract. That's why they had to complete, and they were advised by the brokers and by their attorneys that they needed to go ahead and close. It did not give them a basis to go back to the buyer and say, gee, you know, we didn't really read the contract, therefore we don't have a meeting of the minds and we shouldn't be compelled to close. Those are not cases where you've hired an attorney and you've hired real estate professionals to represent you. Those cases do not say that the attorney or the broker, and particularly the broker knowing this provision of the contract, can remain silent on it, not mention it, and say, here's the contract, here's what it says, it's relied upon, the seller signed the contract, and then have the broker hide behind that and say, gee, I guess you should have read it.
Well, under the law of misrepresentation, if it can be established that the person to whom the misrepresentation was made had the equal means of determining the truth, then there's no action. Seems to me there's an equal means of determining the truth here simply by reading the document.
Well, I think the real question, Your Honor, is reasonable reliance. Did they reasonably rely upon the representation of the broker? Is this a negligent misrepresentation?
Are there any cases that say it's reasonable not to read a contract that you sign because your broker has said what happened in this case?
Your Honor, I would say that first we need to stay focused that this appeal is on summary judgment. It was not an appeal on liability. None of this was presented or argued at the trial court. I still stand for the argument that I just made, that when you hire an attorney and you hire a real estate broker to represent you, and they make representations to you as to what the contract is, that the person who has hired these professionals is not obligated to read that, try to understand the legal implications, which is why they hire these professionals, and those professionals can avoid liability, saying, you know, I guess you didn't need me in the first place. You should have read the contract yourself. That's not the law in Colorado.
Do you have any cases that say that?
I don't, Your Honor. The reason is this was not an issue. I'm not prepared to address that today. This was an issue in the trial court. These were not summary judgments on liability. These were summary judgments based upon whether or not the plaintiffs had more than speculative damages evidence that they should be presented to the jury. The second ground was whether or not there was a appropriate designation of a non-party by the defendants. And the third ground was whether or not the brokers in this case were acting as agents of the buyers, I'm sorry, of the sellers, or they were acting as transaction brokers.
Yeah, let me just interrupt you for a second. You talked about this second issue, but that's not your issue on appeal, is it? That's the cross appeal.
That's the cross appeal, that's correct. But I was trying to point out the three issues resolved on summary judgment.
Okay.
That's where this case ended. We didn't get to the questions of liability in terms of we didn't get to a trial. We didn't have any summary judgments. The brokers didn't file a summary judgment, which said you should have read the contract, and because you didn't read the contract, then you're at more fault than we are, and therefore, I mean, that's a factual question. You can't have a summary judgment on that when you're looking at apportioning fault, is my opinion. What the court did instead is the court here accepted this notion that the damages to be analyzed was a lost profits analysis. And went into the Roberts versus Home Roberts and Owens case and also the Vanderbeek case, which were cited in those summary judgment briefs, which I'm sure the court's familiar with, as well as the opening briefs. Now, in those cases, the court said, you're speculating you may have some transaction in the future from which you may have made some money, but you don't have any evidence of you that you would have had the transactions. You don't have any evidence of what you would have lost. That has no application to this case because we had a transaction. This isn't a hypothetical transaction. Our clients owned the property. They lost the property because of the negligence and the breach of fiduciary duty of the brokers. They got less than the value of their property at the time of that closing and less than they understood they were going to receive.
So was there any evidence that Actis would have bought the property without the credit?
The evidence was that Actis wanted that credit.
Wasn't the evidence stronger than that? Didn't Mr. Grove specify they wouldn't have bought the property without that credit? And, and didn't your client come out just the other way, saying if we had known, we never would have sold it to him?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And that's why in the opening brief of the appellees, I'm sorry, in their answer brief of the appellees, they admitted the but-for. But-for them not disclosing this to the Ludlows, Ludlows never would have entered into the contract.
So how are they damaged then? If they hadn't entered into the contract, how are they
lost their property. That's how this case is different from the ones that they have argued. They had an asset. Let's say you're driving home today from this this argument, and God forbid somebody runs a red light and they total your car. You had an asset. You no longer have the asset because of the negligence of the defendant. You're entitled to bring an action for the value of that asset that you no longer have, that you've lost because of the negligence of that defendant. The trial court would say, in order for you to make a case, you have to prove you had somebody standing in your driveway with a check that was ready to buy your car that day for a specific amount. Otherwise, it's speculative what you may have sold that for in the future.
Did the trial court really say that?
Essentially, that is what the trial court said, Your Honor. What the trial court said was that plaintiffs did not establish by the affidavit of their appraiser, Mr. Rene, that but for the negligence, they would have sold the property to someone else for the full asking price. The court says that it's merely speculation as to when there would be an actual sale. It says without an actual sale on an actual date, the fact finder would be compelled to engage in rampant speculation, thus putting on the Ludlows the burden of proving that of what they would have sold the property for at a later date with, in fact, a sale of property they no longer own, which was an impossible burden for them to meet and is not the proper measure of damages under the law. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the remaining approximately 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
You may. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ken Levinson, and I'm here on behalf of the appellees, which we'll refer to as the brokers. My registration number is 9060. It's clear to me that the court is well-versed in this case. I'm not going to take a lot of your time going through some of the issues I was going to argue. Instead, frankly, I would ask the court if there are any questions or issues you'd like for me to address at this time.
I have a couple. This is a summary judgment, not at the end of trial.
Correct.
Isn't the standard under summary judgment somewhat less than it would be at trial, and isn't evidence of an appraised value of the property sufficient evidence of value to get by summary judgment?
In some cases, yes, but our position is that that's not the case in this case because the measure of damages or the determination of whether there even is damage isn't based upon the appraisal. What we're arguing is when you're trying to sell real estate, it gets appraised. But brokers can't guarantee that there's going to be a buyer who will come along and say, I will pay the appraised price.
But isn't this all a question for the jury or the fact finder, ultimately a trial, to make a finding as to what the property might have sold for? Or I mean, there's not a binding piece of evidence. It's just a piece of evidence. That's all you need for summary judgment to create an issue of material fact.
If you're talking about the amount of damages, yes. But before you get there, you have to figure out whether there's the fact of damages and whether damages have even occurred in a case. And what we're arguing is whether there even is damage.
So what would be adequate evidence of damage in your mind to get by a motion for summary judgment?
In this case, the only thing I can think of would be if there had been testimony from the buyer saying, look, if they just come back and negotiated, I would have given a credit of some amount, or some way to determine that some act of the broker caused the purchase price to stay at a level instead of getting negotiated down to a different level.
Would it have been sufficient, for example, for an expert or perhaps the seller to say, look, I'm familiar with the market. I know that properties have been selling. I've done an analysis. And in my either expert or lay opinion, I think that we could have resold this property to somebody else within 60 days. Would that have been sufficient?
Possibly.
Isn't that what happened in the Republic Insurance case?
I'm not sure about Republic Insurance. I don't remember that one in the brief.
That was cited in the Roberts case.
Oh, okay. I think that is correct. But that didn't happen in this case, of course. The appraiser here said it'd be pure speculation. I have no clue what might have happened and whether a buyer would have come along. So that evidence was lacking in this case.
Mr. Levinson, let's change the hypothetical from one of real estate to something else.
Sure.
Okay, let's say that I own a diamond ring and I've had it appraised at $10,000, and you steal the diamond ring from me and I sue you for stealing the diamond ring from me. Now, I don't have to put on evidence that I was going to sell the diamond ring. I don't have to put on evidence that I was going to that somebody was ready, willing, and able to buy it at that moment. I'm entitled to put on evidence of the appraisal of the value of that diamond ring, and I get the value on the date it's stolen. Why is this different?
Well, first of all, that's an intentional tort, and there's a different measure of damages. Secondly, in those kind of cases, causation isn't an issue. I would have to turn in my license after doing this, would have stolen something from you, and it would have intentionally caused you to lose this asset.
Yes, but here the asset is lost as well. I mean, it may not be an intentional tort. I haven't seen a case, by the way, that draws the distinction you're arguing there. But the asset is lost. So we measure the damage as of the date the asset is lost.
Yes and no. What we're arguing is because this is a professional malpractice case and not an intentional tort type of case, that there is a different calculus that you use in figuring out whether there is compensable damage. So again, we're not talking the amount of damage, but we're talking causation, remoteness, and so on.
Well, I understand, but I guess you're not answering my hypothetical then.
Okay.
In principle, what's the difference? I mean, I have lost my asset. It has been taken from me. It has a value. I did not intend to sell it now or even in the near future, okay? But it's been appraised at $10,000. A court is not going to tell me I don't get my $10,000.
And I think you've actually just hit on the distinction. You weren't intending to sell the item, whereas here the Ludlows were planning to sell it. And it's a question of whether in that sale process a broker can do something negligent and be responsible for the seller not getting the appraised price. In other words, with your item, you wanted to keep it, you weren't going to sell it. Here they were going to sell it, they were negotiating a price, and I keep going back to this, but our belief is that there's no case law that says a real estate broker can be liable if alleged negligence causes the seller to sell an item for less than its appraised value. Because if that were the case, brokers would get sued every time anybody could sell a property and come back later with an appraiser and say, you know, there was somebody out here who might have paid more, and therefore you owe me the difference.
That's not what happened here. Let me ask you a couple of questions.
Sure.
Do you own any stock?
Some, yes.
Okay. Do you get these reports that the SEC requires that they send you every quarter or every too often?
I'm sure I do. Yes.
Do you read them?
Seldom.
Do you would you understand them if you read them?
Probably, if I really put the time into it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the Ludlows, I don't know their background. Okay, I don't know if they're sophisticated real estate investors and engaged in the sale of commercial properties or not. But I would guess a standard real estate contract with an 8-page addendum looks like Greek to them. and to the average customer. And my understanding is that your client inserted a provision in an 8-page addendum that is one sentence at the end of an existing paragraph. And you're claiming the Ludlows are at fault for not noticing it. Is that your understanding? Is that your position?
It is, although in this appeal, I agree with counsel that the liability issues aren't so much involved in the appeal. But there are two things about that. The addendum, first, they had looked at in conjunction with the Bush contract. It's my recollection that their lawyer either drafted that addendum or had seen it before. The second fact that we think makes this different is here you've got the paragraph that had that sentence also says there won't be a contract unless the parties can sit down and negotiate a cost-sharing agreement. And they went off with their attorneys and negotiated that. So this is a term that was there.
But what cost did the buyer take in this negotiation?
I'm sorry, what?
What percentage of the cost did the buyer pay in this negotiation? Because it's supposed to be a sharing of expenses. Right. What percentage or what amount did the buyer pay?
The buyer paid essentially nothing because of the way the agreement got negotiated between Ludlows and Actis and their attorneys. They drafted it. They changed the concept where instead of Actis doing all of the work and getting reimbursed, and Actis had said we want to get reimbursed at closing, it now is a floating thing where either side could do work. And for reasons I still don't understand, the cost-sharing agreement didn't lay all of that out as to who.
As I understand it, the buyer put in the improvements, they would do so presumably with this $1.6 million withheld at closing. But if the seller put in the improvements, they didn't get reimbursed at all. Buyer didn't have to participate in that.
It was supposed to be done that way in the cost-sharing agreement, and I don't know the answer to that. The distinction that I'm aware of is the on-site versus off-site, and what the brokers understood and what Mr. Wilson actually confirmed in his email to Mr. Groves was he thought that referred to the off-site improvements that on the land the Ludlows were keeping. Groves intended it and understood it to mean the on-site, and that's where everything got awry.
So Levinson, let me ask you about a line of argument you make in your answer brief.
Sure.
And it has to do with this, your contention that there really wasn't a meeting of the minds here, because Groves testifies that without the reimbursement, he wouldn't have entered into the contract, and apparently the sellers testified if they'd have known this was going on, they wouldn't have entered into a contract. I get all that. Sure. What I don't get is the connection between that line of argument and where that takes you on this damages issue. Can you help me with that?
It was in the brief, and I think we were raising that more on our issue of the cross appeal having to do with the Mr. Groves and Actis had one intention or understanding, the sellers had a different understanding, and we believe Mr. Groves knew that there was a misunderstanding but didn't correct it. So it doesn't directly relate to the damages.
Thank you. That helped.
You said you just wanted to answer questions, and there's a long pause here. It doesn't seem to be any questions.
Just a couple points, and I'll go sit down. First, I did want to talk to the court about the citation of additional authorities that we cited, and I wanted to apologize to the court. After the briefs were filed, I was researching something in another case. I stumbled on some new cases, and I was reasoning that as an officer of the court, if we know of new case law that affects an appeal or a case, we're supposed to tell you about it. And so that's all we were trying to do. We did it well in advance, and we weren't trying to ambush the other side or anything like that. And then my other point is really two things. First is the Ludlows keep talking about, you know, as Judge Jones was talking, the issue of we had this asset and we lost it. But in the trial court, and particularly in their reply brief to the lawyer defendant's summary judgment motion, they were arguing that what they lost was, quote, the right to sell the property at a future date when they could achieve their desired purchase price. And that's on page 1288 of the record. And so we're arguing, and that's why Roberts versus Holland and Hart is so significant, they were arguing future damages. damages. And then my last real point is there is no negligent misrepresentation claim in this case. Negligent misrepresentation is referenced once in passing in the fiduciary duty claim, but none of the elements of the negligent misrepresentation claim were alleged. They weren't asserted, and we weren't defending at the trial court against a negligent misrepresentation claim. And so we don't believe the case law relating to negligent misrepresentation is applicable. And with that, I think that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes and 14 seconds, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Paul Cooper, registration number 1648 on behalf of the plaintiff. From our point of view, our clients had a valuable piece of property. They had former offers of contracts. They were unwilling to sell at less than $6.2 million. And because of the misrepresentation by the brokers that this was the same kind of contract that had been offered before and then people backed out of, they relied on that and ended up losing their property, not for the price, the minimum price they were willing to accept of 6.2, but for 4.6. That was the sole issue before the judge on this summary judgment issue relating to damages, and that was his ruling was that doesn't show any damage. The case was framed primarily as a legal malpractice case, and I would suggest that the Miller versus Byrne case that's cited in our brief is similar and analogous, because in that case the court held that when you lose a lawsuit, the value of that lawsuit can be addressed by expert testimony, even though it's not the fact finder isn't bound by the expert testimony, but the fact that a lawsuit has value is a proper subject of expert testimony, just as in this case the property's value is the subject of an appraisal. And what happened was our clients lost the right to hold this property and sell it at some time in the future. It's a family trust asset, and they weren't willing to sell it. It was inconsistent with the estate plan for less than 6.2, and they ended up having to because they were misled as to the agreement. And when they signed that agreement after that representation, they were bound by specific performance to go forward. I would suggest that the issue about the cost sharing, that's a factual issue. There's a lot of dispute over those facts. There's a lot of dispute over the facts of whether they were a seller's broker or a dual broker. But the main purpose of the summary judgment, or main granting of the summary judgment, was based on saying that any damage in the future was speculative. That would be true if they still had the property. They would have to prove that they could have sold it for more. But in this case, they lost the property. And I think that's the distinction between the line of cases you were asking about.
Counsel.
Thank you.
We thank counsel for their briefs and argument. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.